Good morning. I'd like to call to order the Water Quality Supply Treatment and Treatment Subcommittee. It's March 22nd, 2023. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Stevenson?
Here.
Vice Chair Maggard?
Here.
Ranking Member Hart?
Here.
Representative Altman? Representative Basabe?
Here.
Representative Bell?
Here.
Representative Brackett?
Here.
Representative Cassell?
Here.
Representative Dunkley?
Here.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman? Representative Gossett-Seidman?
Here.
Representative Henson is excused. Representative Overdorff?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Robinson?
Here.
Representative Snyder?
Here.
Representative Temple?
Here.
Representative Waldron?
Here.
Representative Yeager?
Here.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Well, thank you for all for being here bright and early this morning for this committee. Before we begin, once the daily reminder to please put your phones on the silent mode, and I will verify mine is silent as well, to make sure all electronic devices are turned off and placed on silent mode. Good morning. Members, today we have three bills and four presentations. We're going to be hearing from some of our utilities who are also huge parts of taking care of Florida's water, water quality, all those kinds of things. With that, I think we should begin. First up, we have PCS for House Bill 847, Floating Vessels, Platforms, and Floating Boat Lifts by Rep. Stark. Members, this bill is before us today because the amendment that was adopted on March 8th contained an amendment to the relating to clause. House Rule 711D requires that a bill with an amended relating to clause in the title be temporarily postponed. Such an amended bill may be heard in a subsequent meeting of the same subcommittee after being noticed as a proposed committee substitute, and that is where we are today. Representative Stark, you are recognized to explain PCS for House Bill 847.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, and committee members. I'm here today to present House Bill 847 again. So 847, as amended, simply states that the registration process for floating vessel platforms are FVPs. And if you say that three times real fast, I'll be really proud of you. The bill maintains that the vessel platform compliance with local ordinances, codes, meets certain criteria and does not alter environmental oversight. Additionally, the bill will assist any constituents in reducing fees since it will be a one-time fee to them. This is a standardized statewide permitting process for the installation only. And that is the bill, Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions of the sponsor? Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Representative.
Good morning.
Thank you for reaching out. I greatly appreciate that. I have one question. Does this bill only apply to the floating vessel platforms that are being added to the previously permitted dock or bulkheads?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. It is not changing anything else. This is just the FVPs being permitted, one-time permit.
Are there any other questions? Okay, seeing none, is there public testimony on the bill? There is. We have, Well, we'll go back to Ranking Member Hart for an additional question.
Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that. Excuse me. I apologize for that, Representative. We know that the consistency in permitting requirements is a desirable thing that we'd all like to have. And I've gained some comfort knowing that this only applies to things that are being added or previously permitted docks. But what I'd really like to know, relying on the self-certification, does that carry any risk for you? And would you be opposed to maybe having them bring photos of where that dock is really located?
Representative Stark, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I think all of this is locally maintained. It goes all by the ordinances from the municipalities. So whatever they require would be what would be brought forward. The self-certification is the same as it is now.
Is there a follow-up?
Ma'am, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I understand that there is the, if there's something already there and they're self-certifying, and if they made it, and I know you have parameters on how big it is, how small it is, how long it is, and all that. Would you be opposed, though? Because currently, no municipality require you to bring them any photos or anything like that. But would you be opposed to having them, since they're self-certifying, forced to ensure that they're not putting it on top of one of our seagrass, where we're fighting to improve that, and it actually happens to go on top of it? I was just wondering, would you be open to adding photos to it?
Thank you. You may have answered that question, but if you could provide some additional information.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I personally wouldn't be opposed to it. I'm sure that that would be up to the individual municipalities, again, for their permitting processes.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, there is public testimony on the bill. Timothy Riley from Jet Deck. Waves in support. I believe we're getting some late-breaking participation here. Okay, they are for other bills. Members, is there any debate on the bill? Representative Waldron, you're recognized.
Yeah, I just have one quick comment, and you know, I am up on the bill. I just want to make sure that. As much as possible, I remain a little bit concerned about the possible negative impact it might have on our ports, and just ask that that be considered as much as possible as you move forward. So,
thank you. Representative Stark, you are recognized to close on your bill.
I'll waive to the close. Thank you, Chair.
Missy, will you please call the roll on PCS for House Bill 847?
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Sabe?
Yes.
Bill?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cassell?
Yes.
Dunkley?
Yes.
Gonzalez-Pittman?
Yes.
Gossett-Seidman?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Haggard?
Yes.
Oberdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Robinson?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Yeager?
Yes.
Chair Stevenson?
Yes. Members, by your vote, the bill is reported favorably.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Next up, we have House Bill 979, Deepwater Port Dredging, by Representative Gossett-Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are recognized. You are recognized to explain House Bill 979.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Chair, members, good morning. This is a common sense bill for what is left of the 348 miles of coral reefs offshore Florida. For some background, many dredging operations have been slogging away in our waters to collect and transport sand. They have toiled offshore for decades to nourish sand on beaches and remove sand from our ports to deepen and widen them. Both operations maintain they contribute to the tourism, fishing, diving, and commerce, and this is true. However, dredging also has its risk. During the Biscayne Bay and Miami dredging operation, a series of miscalculations and false reports led to 560,000 coral to die off and 200 acres of seagrass to fail and turn into just sandy sludge. This caused unspeakable damage. This has been documented by numerous scientific and government agencies and journals. And in short, the operation's effects the coral were falsely reported, as six coral only died. Meanwhile, offshore sand dredging pits are existing in the ocean offshore from Boca Raton, my district, down to the Keys, the top of the Keys. As viewed in sonar photos, these sand mines look like football fields, completely barren of sand 20 to 30 feet deep and 60 feet wide. Sadly, the first reef that was situated in this has pretty much disappeared. Used to be in 15 to 20 feet of water. It's been covered in sand from these operations. It's a limestone cemetery of smashed dead coral and hanging staghorn skeletons. Gone, too, are the tiny sea creatures that live on that reef. There are things such as invertebrates, shrimp, octopus larvae, conchs, sand dollars, stingrays, and seagrass that previously inhabited these reefs and fed the multitudes of beautiful fish. Much of this damage could have been avoided with careful planning and competent follow-through. Now 80% of our reefs are dead, and in order to help save the remaining 20%, this bill is one way to help. It will provide foresight and integrity on determining the habitat impact in advance of the sand dredging by contractors. It requires that analysis to determine the natural impact would be conducted by a third party separate from the dredging operation. Secondly, it would require the municipality who is organizing and conducting the dredging to advise neighboring communities. This bill has been cross-checked with DEP guidelines and supported by the American Sport Fishing Association, the Conservation of Public Policy Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, and the Water Keepers, and that is the bill.
Members, are there questions of the sponsor? Representative Bell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this good bill forward. Question, who would be the third party in that bill?
Yes, ma'am.
You're recognized.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair. Yes, that would be there are many businesses which do these studies, and this could even open up further business conducted this, but they're currently on the books, and they work, they're subcontractors, they already work with DEP, EPA, and other agencies for water sampling and environmental studies, so that would be that whole grouping separate from the actual contractor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative. I just have one question. I noticed that in the strike all, we abandon, there's no mention of habitat equivalency analysis. Is there a reason why that was taken away?
Yes, ma'am. Chair.
Excuse me. I forgot. Might that be explained in the amendment? We do have an amendment.
Yes, ma'am.
To consider. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Is there any other questions on the bill? Okay. Thank you. We have an amendment. Representative Gossett-Seidman, barcode 71141. You are recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. The amendment does, in fact, remove the reference to that habitat in order to comply with DEP guidelines currently, and so as not to have them rewrite their guidelines for analysis and working with them and honoring their current analysis.
I beg your pardon, I have to correct. The barcode is 771141. Are there questions on the amendment? Ranking Member Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe I just didn't quite understand it. Would we not want to approve that habitat equivalency analysis? Go ahead.
Recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, DEP currently has guidelines in place that would work with this angle. And we were working our bill in order to not double talk or, write over their current guidelines. But they would refer the language, if you'll notice, is just altered to say when this is conducted, not that it must be required. Yes, ma'am.
Is there public testimony on the amendment? Oh, we have Stephen Uccino, who is an okay. You'd like to speak? You're recognized.
Thank you so much, Pepper Uccino. Stephen's my first name, but I do go by Pepper. On behalf of Florida Shore and Beach Preservation Association, I'm the president of the association. We spoke extensively with your staff yesterday afternoon, so I think we have a better understanding of the intentions of the bill. You know, I have the unenviable task of still standing up here in opposition of the bill. We already have extensive regulation of beach nourishment and those sorts of activities in 161. It's the statute in which was reorganized in 1986, in which beach restoration was also included in 403-816, and I'm trying to track down the historical understanding of why that happened. Currently, it seems like an orphan in the statute. So, you know, that's one of the things. But 161 for beach restoration has extensive requirements on restoration and maintenance activities on Florida shores, which includes maintenance, dredging, sand bypassing, inlet management, et cetera. That data from those pre-construction surveys and assessments, during construction assessments and monitoring, and extensive post-construction monitoring, that data all comes through DEP. It does not go through the engineering firms. I can't speak to the ports issue. I'm not familiar with that one, on how the data does come to the state or to the agencies. But for the beach activities, all those data come through DEP without being, you know, reviewed or scrubbed or whatever may have happened in past incidences. So they do come through DEP. The other thing that I mentioned that I noticed in the amendment is the 5-year pre-prohibition and post-prohibition for independent monitoring. I don't know if we have enough consultants and environmental firms that could have that sort of 10-year window where they're not associated with any other engineering projects or whatnot. So that's just another concern for the amendment. But I'm happy to take any questions on behalf of the association.
I do believe it's a 5-year. I think you may want to take a review of the one. It's not
five.
A 10-year. It's I believe it's.
It's five on each side, so 5-year pre and 5-year post.
5-year pre, okay.
So right. It would be a combination of 10.
Okay.
Sorry, Chair.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Members, is there debate on the amendment? Wait, break your... Is there debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Gossett-Seidman, you are recognized to close on the amendment.
Thank you, Chair. I think the key with this bill lies in two words: third party. The Miami operation, which was around 20 years ago, after the reference to the gentleman who just spoke before me, was conducted with a company affiliated with the actual dredging. So if we have a third party, which has been highly recommended by numerous scientific and environmental units, that third party will be held more accountable, not having been paid directly by the dredging operation. It is a very simple fix, giving us all more oversight. And with DEP's guidelines in place, it should be a much better work to avoid any future dredging outfalls. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gossett-Seidman has closed on her amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say yay.
Yay.
All opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. In accordance with House Rule 7.11D, we'll have to show 979 temporarily postponed, so we'll be in compliance.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a House Bill 1405, Biosolids, by Representative Tuck. Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. I know it's early in the morning, but biosolids is sure to wake you up. Florida's Clean Waterways Act states that the legislature finds that it is in the best interest of the state to minimize the migration of nutrients that impair water bodies. While this act has substantially strengthened permitting requirements for Class B biosolids, it did not specifically provide targeted protections for Florida's already impaired waterways. Recent studies confirmed that the land application of Class B biosolids has caused and will continue to cause substantial pollution problems in impaired waterways. House Bill 1405 is a conservative, incremental next step on building on the solid foundation of the Clean Waterways Act. It provides an additional common sense protection for Florida's already impaired watersheds by limiting the land application of Class B biosolids within them. HB 1405 also creates a grant program to incentivize local community projects to accelerate Florida's transition to higher levels of economically sustainable biosolids treatment. That is the bill, Madam Chair, and there is a strike all.
Thank you. We do have an amendment, but first, are there any questions of the sponsor? Seeing none, Representative Tuck, you're recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the strike all amendment is meant to mirror the Senate language. The biggest change is taking the grant out of the wastewater grant program that is currently in place and creating a new biosolids grant program that outlines different requirements that better fits the goal of the bill, and that is the strike all.
Thank you. Members, are there questions on the amendment? Representative Cassell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Tuck, for reaching out. If you could just provide a little bit more of a detailed explanation of why the changes in the strike all specifically related to the statute of reference, why it was changed from the original bill to the strike all.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for the question. If you're referring to the grant program that I just mentioned, we're taking it out of the wastewater grant program because the provisions that are outlined in that current grant program didn't meet what we thought would be the best use of these potential funds. It's always subject to appropriation. However, we do outline certain requirements. For example, we outline 33% of the funds have to be used for two certain provisions that are going to help with the composting and things of that nature, and then 10% to the rural areas of opportunity because they're also subject to the same water quality provisions that larger areas are with a minimal tax base. So that those are the main points.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I have one. Okay, I'll wait for the amendment. Good point. Okay, we have an amendment. Representative Tuck, barcode 313419. Oh, you did that. Okay, I'm sorry. Is there public testimony on the amendment? Questions on the amendment? I'm sorry. I need to go back for my second cup of coffee, ladies and gentlemen. Seeing no questions. Julie Rathmeal from Audubon, Florida. You are recognized.
I was hoping to speak on the bill as amended.
Oh, okay. We can do that.
I don't know if that's helpful. Wait.
We'll need coffee this morning.
It's okay. I do too.
Okay. Well, we'll get you back. Is there public testimony on the amendment? Let me see. Do I see any? No. No. Okay. Is there debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Tuck, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll waive close.
Representative Tuck, having waived closed, all in favor of the amendment say yay.
Yay. Yay.
All opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. We are back on the bill as amended. There is public testimony on the bill as amended. Julie Rathmeal, Audubon, Florida.
Madam Chair, I appreciate it. I'm Julie Rathmel, Executive Director of Audubon, Florida. This bill aims to address a really important issue, which is the spreading of Class B biosolids. They are a substantial source of nitrogen and phosphorus that fuels harmful algal blooms in our lakes, rivers, and coastal waters. South Florida has long had a prohibition on land application of Class B biosolids, a prohibition that Audubon worked hard to put in place to protect the greater Everglades ecosystem. And this bill would rightly extend those same protections to the rest of the state's impaired watersheds. In combination with the first part of the bill, however, creating a grant program that supports the conversion from Class B to Class AA biosolids, we have to think through the logical consequences of this legislation. So if wastewater managers no longer have as many places to dispose of this material, what is going to be done with it? So some context, Class AA biosolids are largely just Class B biosolids that have been dried. They have less bacteria, sometimes have soil amendments added to improve their attractiveness as fertilizer. But the thing that matters most, they still have the same extreme loads of algae bloom fueling nitrogen and phosphorus that Class B biosolids have. One major difference, however, is that while DEP tracks and restricts how much and where Class biosolids can be spread, It does not track the application of Class AA at all. They can be sold and used anywhere as fertilizer, next to wetlands, in impaired watersheds, even in the South Florida counties where Class B biosolids have been prohibited for years. So while the good intentions of this bill make public dollars available to incentivize local governments to convert Class B to AA, the state has no tracking requirement for AAs. And while this isn't a problem that's created by the bill, its provisions have the effect, by prohibiting the spreading of Class B and incentivizing the conversion to AA, to creating much more AA that's going to need disposal in our state, with no tracking in place to monitor it. So as it is currently written, the bill stops just short of solving our problem. Are there potential other uses for this material? That's what the bill hopes to incentivize, which is really smart. But until innovative technologies are proven effective and scalable, we're just going to be repackaging nutrients as AA and making it harder to quantify and track. These shortcomings could be very easily corrected with amendment language, and we would love to work with both the House and the Senate sponsor, because we know that this isn't the intent of the bill. We think that clarifying language to ensure that the grant funding can be used to encourage innovative technology for other uses than fertilizer, and most importantly, requiring the tracking of Class AA biosolids by DEP, so that if we find there's a large increase in those AA land applications and it's being spread near wetlands or in impaired watersheds, which is currently allowed, we'll know about it. We'll understand the magnitude of the problem, and you guys will be able to address it in subsequent legislation. So this bill is driving a really important, long overdue conversation about biosolids, and the sponsors really are to be congratulated for that. It's advancing creative new ideas for dealing with the challenges, and we'd be grateful for the opportunity to work together to build those tracking requirements into the language so that it can realize its full potential in addressing this problem for Florida. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe there's a question from one of the members. Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you, ma'am. I actually had three questions, if that's okay.
You're recognized.
Ma'am, are you aware of the current labeling and sale requirements for AA biosolids?
Yes, there are labeling and sale requirements, but there's not tracking that's sharing exactly where it's going. So we don't have an understanding of how much and of how much nutrient loading is going into which watersheds in Florida.
You're recognized.
Thank you so much. So we have the labeling and sale requirements, so DEP is able to track, you know, what is being sold, how much is being sold. Are you aware of any tracking of, say, Home Depot fertilizer that goes on people's lawns or goes on other areas like that?
No, but this is a brand new source, and it's a source that's coming from the public sector. So this is coming from all of our homes and from our cities and counties as they're treating our wastewater.
You're recognized, Representative Overdorf.
Thank you so much. We can debate about that most certainly. And being a new source, it's an old technology. It's been around for quite some time. But that being said, I don't want to get into debate with you. The final question would be, you've talked a lot about the biosolids themselves, and that, you know, I think we all recognize that it's a problem that is out there. But one thing I didn't hear from you, you said you wanted to work with a sponsor, but I didn't hear any solutions. Does Audubon have solutions that we could utilize now?
You're recognized.
Thank you, ma'am. At the moment, we're just asking for the addition of tracking provisions in the bill so that we're able to actually quantify how many more AAs are we putting into the market and where are they being distributed? If we're going to use public tax dollars in order to make this conversion possible, it seems a reasonable expectation for taxpayers to understand how they're being disposed of.
Take it as a no. Okay.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I have a question. It's my understanding that AA biosolids are treated for vectors and viruses, I guess, those kind of things that are public health risk. But it is not my understanding that they're all dry. It is my understanding that they can be both wet and dry as an option. Is that your understanding as well?
I think the degree to which they're dried varies. But yes, I think that that some of them are dried to a greater extent than others.
My understanding is that there are bulk transfers to agricultural areas, and it is they may not be complete, maybe not completely wet, but is not dry like as in fertilizer dry. So just wanted to make that clarification. Thank you. I appreciate you being here, and thank you for working on behalf of the water.
Of course, always. And thank you.
Mr. Draper, Eric Draper. Eric Draper is waving in support of the bill. Let me see if there's. Eric Draper, Public Trust for Conservation, waving in support of the bill. Nicole Fogarty, St. Lucie County Government Relations Director. Come on down. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nicole Fogarty, St. Lucie County. We are in support of the bill. We have spoken with the sponsor. We feel like this is a great step forward in the direction of what is becoming an ongoing issue, especially when we move from those individuals from septic tank to sewer conversion. So we look forward to working with the sponsor and just want to put in our support. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. John November, also from the Public Trust for Conservation. You're recognized.
John November, I'm the Executive Director of the Public Trust for Conservation. This bill is critical for Florida's clean water future. The Clean Waterway substantially strengthened the rules related to land application of Class B biosolids. What this bill does is adds a targeted additional geographic protection for our most vulnerable watersheds, water bodies, and water body segments in Florida. Really importantly, it incentivized local governments who are going to need an alternative to Class B to upgrade their treatment to Class AA. I think it's really important to say that the bill specifically incentivizes projects that are going to be economically viable and environmentally beneficial. And the way that we're going to determine if they're economically viable is by doing a market analysis and an economic analysis to determine if the products created as AAs are actually going to be valuable on the market and whether they're going to reduce the amount of nutrients and other pollutants that are that can degrade waterways. So we understand the concerns of many environmentalists that Class AA traditionally does not reduce the amount of nutrients and other pollutants of emerging concern. However, there are innovative technologies available, and there's one that's tried and true and been around for a long time, and that's called compost. And it's a very inexpensive thing that can be done by rural communities without breaking the bank and turning this Class AA biosolids into a valuable product that in the end helps with water quantity issues because it helps retain water. It helps with reducing the amount of synthetic fertilizers that we have to place on crops because it keeps nutrients in the soils, and it's going to help water quality as a whole because we're not going to be applying the same concentration of nitrogen and phosphorus in the Class AA biosolids that we would originally have applied in the Class B. Now, this isn't the case for all Class AA biosolids. A lot of traditional Class AA biosolids that are just dried or granulated don't necessarily change the nutrient content of the phosphorus and nitrogen in that AA biosolids. However, those projects are not likely to be prioritized by the FDEP because they are weighing whether there's going to be economic viability of those products and environmental whether it'll be environmentally beneficial. So I think many folks' concerns about the bill that we're just going to be changing the form of the biosolids I understand the concern, but hopefully through the prioritization process, we're going to weed out projects that don't take those higher levels of treatment to make the biosolids more valuable, more versatile, and more environmentally responsible. So I do have to thank Representative Tuck for her amazing work on the bill so far. She's been a great sponsor, and we look forward to taking these important next steps, and I'm open to answer any questions you guys may have.
Members, are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes public testimony on the amendment. Is there debate on the amendment? On the bill, sorry. We are back on the bill. There's public testimony on the bill. Okay, members, is there any debate on the bill as amended? Well, seeing none, Representative Tuck, you are recognized to close on House Bill 1405.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, members, for hearing this bill today. We're not going to solve Florida's water quality issues overnight, but this is a great incremental step, so I would ask for everybody's favorable support. And with that, I close. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Missy, will you please call the roll on House Bill 1405?
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Basabe?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Cassell?
Yes.
Dunkley?
Yes.
Gonzalez-Pittman?
Yes.
Gossett-Seidman?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Robinson?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
Yeager?
Yes.
Chair Stevenson?
Yes, ma'am. Members, by your vote, the bill is reported favorably.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Congratulations. At this time, I'd like to welcome West Gregory, Director of the Office of Agriculture Water Policy in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, to provide an overview of the work his office is engaged in, best management practices, and some of the things the department is doing to protect Florida's water. We will have time for questions after the presentation has concluded. You are recognized.
Good morning, Chair. Hello, committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Wes Gregory. I'm the director of the Office of Agricultural Water Policy. And as the chair indicated, I'm here to give you a little overview about what our office does. All right. Awesome. The mission of our office is to implement strategies that protect Florida's resources while promoting sustainable agriculture. We have many, many responsibilities, and our diverse responsibilities include developing agricultural best management practices, and then verifying their proper implementation, managing a cost share program that supports agricultural non-point source best management practices and water resource projects, developing estimates of statewide agricultural water demand, and developing scientific and technical research statewide to support existing best management practices and to investigate new best management practices that may be more effective. So we'll talk about the first responsibility of our office that you might be most familiar with, which is our agricultural best management practices. These are management strategies on the landscape that are intended to increase the efficiency of nutrient management, irrigation management, and water resource protection. These are practical, cost-effective actions that agricultural producers can take to conserve water and reduce or control the amount of pesticides, fertilizers, animal waste, and other pollutants that may enter our water bodies in Florida. Their applicability is based on the intensity of the operation, and they must balance agricultural production along with water resource protection. Our field staff, when they go out and visit with a producer, identifies all best management practices that are applicable to the producer's operation and promote management decisions that allow the producer to be as efficient as possible. I'll go into a little more detail about that. Our department currently has 9 BMP manuals divided up by commodity of what's produced by agricultural producers and a statewide state imperiled species manual. These are how all of our best management practices are documented and give instructions to producers on how to implement them. In the past few years, we have met with different producer groups and a variety of stakeholders that have interest in this on the manuals to address potential updates reflecting developments in the industry and developments in technology. These updates are going to be targeted to fix the problems we've identified, and the solution's going to be tailored to fit the problem that we're seeing. That's going to include clearly identifying producer responsibilities, connecting our sign-up BMP sign-up checklist to our narrative that explains how to do the BMPs, adding science-based solutions, and we're excited about the new technologies that are out there that we can add into these BMP manuals because they are in need of being updated. The next few slides I'm going to go through are going to give you some examples of BMPs and kind of divide them up into groups. Nutrient management BMPs help determine nutrient needs and sources. These BMPs help manage nutrient application to minimize the impact of resources. This manages how the fertilizer is put on the land and controls where it's going. The first one I've put up there for you is precision fertilization. This is using soil samples and tissue samples from the plants and application technologies to determine how much fertilizer needs to be put on the land. Using the farmer is only putting on the amount they need. They don't want to put more on than they need. That's more expensive. But it's also better for the environment to do that. So it's using that kind of technology to only put down what is needed. The other technology I've put before you is the variable rate technology. This is changing the rate based on the plant species and the stage of the plant's life. So a smaller, younger plant might not need as much fertilizer or nutrients. So the technology or technique they're using would apply less. And the bigger tree or bigger plant would need less nutrients or fertilizer. So the technology or the technique would apply more on that. But it's again, it's only putting down what's needed. Some of you may be familiar with the four R's of nutrient management. That is right source, right rate, right time, and right place. Those are all in some of our BMP manuals, and it kind of categorizes different nutrient management techniques, and we'd like to incorporate that more into our nutrient manuals to kind of put them in context for the producer to use. Oh, another cool picture. Irrigation management is our next big category of BMPs. Our irrigation management BMPs address the method and scheduling of irrigation to reduce water and nutrient losses in the environment. The first example I'm giving you today is the soil moisture probes. These measure water moving through the soil, moving through the root zone. When you water, it picks up the fertilizer and moves through the root zone. But producers want to keep that water and fertilizer nutrients in the root zone. Anything past that is a waste, is potentially harmful to our environment. So these probes measure water moving through the area, through the soil, and so it helps producers decide when and to water their plants, whether to do it now or later. It helps them make good decisions. It's also a cost saving for them. That can be teamed up with our precision irrigation. This is placing water where it's needed for the plants. It's not just having water sprayed everywhere, it's putting it down exactly where it's needed, whether that's through drip irrigation or overhead spraying, as you see here. It's done, it's done based on what type of plant is being produced, and it's using the most efficient technology that we have possible. With funding from the legislature, our department funds irrigation system evaluations to determine efficiencies through our mobile irrigation lab program. There's about 10 of those throughout the state. What happens is our field staff and our mobile irrigation staff goes out and meets with the producer and evaluates the irrigation system to determine efficiencies and see where improvements can be made. Using the results of a mobile irrigation evaluation, we can also provide cost share to producers so that their irrigation systems become more efficient, save on water, and they're using the best technology. Examples of things they can adopt are conversions to variable rate systems, remote control of irrigation systems, and soil moisture probes. I've seen them use this. It's all on their iPhone. It's really cool. It's neat. Our next category and the last category I'm going to talk about in BMPs is our surface water control structures and our water resource protections. This is constructing things like buffers and setbacks. These reduce or prevent the transport of sediments and nutrients from production areas to water bodies by acting as a physical barrier to the movement of nutrients. So that's like building a barrier, building a swell, or planting a set of plants that'll stop the movement of the sediments and the nutrients from the field going into the water bodies that we're concerned about. So those are our BMPs. Our next big responsibility in our office is our cost share program. This provides funding to our producers to help implement the BMPs. It's usually done on a 75-25 cost split where the department is providing 75% of the funds and the producer is providing 25% of the funds to purchase new technologies or adopt new techniques to implement best management practices. These funds come from the legislature. It's usually from general revenue or the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And the way we do this is when our field staff is going out to meet with producers for a sign-up or inspection verification, they are also identifying new best management practices the producers can adopt and identifying that they can have cost share to help adopt those. And we're trying to get the best bang for our buck, identify the most efficient things, and target specific areas and sometimes specific crops to help control the fertilizer and nutrient spread. Oh, in our office, we're also trying to emphasize interagency coordination. We like to work with other agencies like DEP, the Water Management Districts, and the Federal Department of Agriculture to leverage the dollars we have to work together and be able to allow the producers to adopt the most efficient, most effective, economical BMPs possible. Another area we're trying to emphasize in our cost share program is also a regional project. These are larger projects, such as a water control structure, or where those are not possible, also emphasizing certain BMPs and targeting areas and targeting certain crops or techniques to more effectively and more efficiently use our resources to control nutrients moving through the system. I'd like to talk real quick about our BMP enrollment process. I'm just gonna scoot through. when we do an enrollment visit, staff meets with the producer and they kind of tour the area, tour the farm, and they identify all the BMPs that the producer is using and others that they can use that are applicable. And they use our sign-up, our checklist that's adopted in our manual to sign the producers up, and they're agreeing to implement those BMPs. Next, during our implementation verification visits, our producers go back to the farm or the ranch or what have you to verify proper implementation of the applicable BMPs, and they're checking to make sure things are being done right in the most efficient way possible and also talk about cost share that's possible. Also on these visits, our staff are collecting nutrient records from the producers so we know what kind of nutrients are going into the system. This is a new requirement. It was passed in 2020 in the Clean Waterways Act, and so our implementation and verification visits are done every 2 years. During both enrollment and implementation verification visits, we provide producers guidance and technical assistance. We identify opportunities to assist producers in the implementation of their BMPs through cost share and in order to achieve the next level of precision on the landscape. In the first 2 years since this became a requirement for our department, 93% of those signed up for BMPs in BMAP areas have had an IV visit, and 98% of those signed up for BMPs in the priority BMAP areas, and that's the areas around Lake Okeechobee, have received an IV visit, and we've made sure that they are properly implementing the best management practices. Another big responsibility of our office is the regulatory planning effort. We work with other agencies to help ensure there is a sufficient supply of water for agricultural producers and they're using what they need. We work with the water management districts to identify current agricultural uses and to project those uses into the future so they can use that data for their permitting and planning efforts. We also work with the Department of Environmental Protection to help develop their basin management action plans, their BMAPs. We identify what producers are using BMPs in the area, their effectiveness, and also help identify projects that DEP can promote to help control nutrient management and runoff from agricultural production. Also, as part of our regulatory planning effort, we have developed the Florida Statewide Agricultural Irrigation Demand GIS tool. This is a GIS mapping tool utilized to model and submit data to coordinating agencies and partners. This is to help them make their permitting decisions and their water supply decisions. It helps make water use estimations. And the last big area of our responsibilities is scientific and technical research. Our office supports research to provide the scientific and technical justification for our BMP program and to investigate innovative new practices that improve nutrient and irrigation use efficiencies. Studies funded by our office must address at least one of our office's priorities, which may include agronomic rates, control release fertilizer efficiencies, irrigation management technologies, soil health, and the other priorities are listed on this slide on the website I provided. I do note that our office has been funding this kind of research for a long time, but recently in the Clean Waterways Act, it became a requirement for us to submit our research plan to you guys when we're doing our legislative budget request. So we're now doing that also. Quickly, a few other responsibilities we have is coordinating with the Water Management District Agricultural Outreach Teams, the federal USDA, and the University of Florida IFAS Extension agents to do outreach and do education for our producers to help them understand why it's important to do best management practices and why they need to adopt these new technologies and provide them the opportunity to come in and do cost share. Further, we participate in state and federal regulatory developments for things such as the Central and South Florida Flood Control Program, Everglades Restoration, and the Northern Everglades and Estuaries Protection Plan. I'd like to thank you guys for letting me come today and explain what my office does. I think there's a lot of opportunities to improve water quality in Florida. The best way to do that is providing agricultural producers the tailored precision farming tools available for their specific crops that they can, so that they can better manage their nutrient use. And also emphasizing regional projects which are efficient and effective way of managing nutrient runoff from agricultural production. And I'd be happy to take any of your questions, subject to the chair letting me do that.
Thank you, and I think you have a taker. Yes. Representative Cassell, you're recognized.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, Mr. Gregory, for that presentation, especially with regards to the BMPs. You know, we know that the BMPs, though, aren't mandatory, right? They're voluntary. Are you running into any situations where people are not instituting BMPs? And if so, you know, how do you monitor that, or how do you encourage them to implement them?
Mr. Gregory, you're recognized.
Yes, ma'am. BMPs are actually mandatory in the BMAP areas in the sense that the producer either has to sign up for our BMPs or do water quality monitoring. So that's not all of the states. So there are parts of the state where it is voluntary. Where folks are not implementing BMPs, where it is mandatory, if they flat out refuse to do that, we refer them to DEP for enforcement. However, there's two sides of it. They can also be implementing them incorrectly, so we provide them compliance assistance in our site visits and bring them into the process and help them come into compliance rather than hitting them over the head with an enforcement action. There are folks who still won't do it, and then they are referred to DEP, and that's all laid out in our Rule 5M1.
And I'll intervene here just briefly. I understand there have been some enforcement actions brought by DEP in the last maybe 2 years. So.
Yes, and we intend to work with them and help them out with that and provide them the best information available so they can go out and do those enforcement actions.
Like many rules and laws that we have, it's not about punishing. It's about getting the compliance that we need. I'm just going to say how impressed I have been with the work that's being done in my area, the Tri-Ag area, which is Putnam, St. John's, and I believe it's Clay, the three. Maybe it's Putnam, St. John's, Flagler. But some very impressive things that have made land that we never thought would be able to be used for agriculture to be used in innovative ways. We have high clay pan. We have a high clay pan layer, and it's been very beneficial and allows them to both address flooding and get nutrients and things to the plants at just the right time in the growth cycle. The science that's going on, the research that's going on in optimizing fertilization and water use for plants is very impressive. And it's amazing to see. If you haven't been out to your, you know, one of those research facilities, there is good stuff going on. And I think there's increasing buy-in from and real excitement in the agriculture community when they find things that are both cost-effective and work, because they want to do the right thing and they want to be efficient. So, Representative Cassell, you got a follow-up.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for providing that detail. It's great insight that you have. Following up with regards to the BMPs, obviously, as we realize that they're working, you know, they're getting the results that we need, would it make sense at a certain point to, in those situations where it's still considered to be voluntary, to actually make them mandatory across the state, put those best management practices into statute so we have a little bit more of an enforcement tool by putting those BMPs into statute?
You're recognized.
Like I said, they are mandatory in certain areas. I would think it would be best to emphasize in areas where we're seeing those water quality problems, and I would agree with that it's necessary to do it there.
Okay, thank you. Voluntary at this point, but, you know, we'll see. Okay. All right, Representative Hart, Ranking Member Hart, you are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you very much for the presentation. I had no idea that we could measure how much water went into the ground with an iPhone,
right.
How much fertilizer is going in. That's critically
really
important. How often do we actually monitor the agriculture water quality BMPs in person?
We go out every 2 years to someone who is signed up. And as I mentioned before, we are at 98% IV visits in our priority BMAP areas and 93% in all of our BMAPs area. And we're trying to improve that also. Of course, the goal is 100%. If you're talking about,
You can finish your answers.
If you're talking about water quality monitoring, that is a responsibility of the Department of Environmental Protection, and we work with them to identify producers who will let them on the land and do the water quality monitoring. And I'd like to encourage that relationship with them to show that our BMPs are effective and that they're doing what they're supposed to do.
You're recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Do you have any resources that you need in order to be able to maybe go more often?
Actually, we have made that request in our amended budget request. Our commissioner is proposing a lot of great things to improve the work throughout our entire department. I'm most excited about enterprise GIS tools because I like maps. But we've also asked for my office in particular more funding for doing cost share to encourage more people to do BMPs. And we've also asked for more staff. We have directed a lot of our efforts to these implementation verification visits, and it's really stretched our staff thin, so we need to add more field staff, add another GIS person and another contracts person to sign more people up for BMPs and get them into the cost share programs if they need to do that to implement those BMPs. So we're asking for that, and I really appreciate your support for that if you can.
And one final, I think she's going to get you that budget.
Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if Florida A&M is participating in this research?
I am not aware, but I would be open to that because I know they're a land-grant university, and that would be wonderful.
Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You talked about some, as you're saying, you're developing new and innovative BMPs, and that you are prioritizing those that are the best bang for your buck. Can you give me an example of a new BMP, and what is your criteria for a better bang for your buck?
You're recognized.
Yes, ma'am. Control-release fertilizer technology is making big strides right now, and it's a big get in areas of like North Florida, where we see where it's more difficult to monitor water quality because it's moving through the karst system. So if we are better controlling fertilizer that way and nutrient movement, that would do a great thing. It's becoming more affordable as the technology gets better, and we're seeing more producers wanting to implement that, and we're willing to engage with them to do that.
Follow up.
Thank you. I do want to clarify something that, in fact, under Chair Payne's Clean Waterways Act, that BMPs are, in fact, mandatory, and we do have it down to 20 acres for the BMPs as well as the inspections. But that being said, we have a 20-acre requirement for everything above 20 acres that you're supposed to be doing these inspections and BMPs. Would it be a better situation overall for your department if, in fact, we had that threshold at 50 acres instead, so that you might, that might be a way of dealing with your FTEs?
You're recognized.
Yes, sir. It actually kind of depends. Some of them are more intense operations or are on smaller acreages, depending on what they're growing. We may have larger acreages where it's less intense, such as cow cattle operations, which we see less, but they're bigger areas. And then smaller areas may be more intense because they're growing fruit and vegetable crops. So it's not necessarily the exact solution.
Well, I mean, obviously with an agricultural operation that is, say, an egg operation or a pig operation, something like that, obviously you're going to have increased monitoring there. I was more talking about you have a fair amount of 20-acre ranchettes, say, I know in the Wellington area, in my area, in Martin County, that may not necessarily need that significant monitoring. So the last question, I think you kind of answered this previously, though, is that with your FTEs and the ability to do inspections, I'm assuming you're requesting additional FTEs to do inspections and therefore not have to turn over in bulk the farms that were not able to be inspected and therefore are facing a violation and putting them over to DEP.
You're recognized.
Yes, sir. I'd like to bring people into compliance, not smack them over the head.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, seeing none, thank you very much. Thank you for your work, and we appreciate the food and open space that agriculture supplies and their focus on increasing their stewardship of our water. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have Alicia Keeter, General Manager of the South Walton Utility Company. Members, we're going to hear from representatives of three utilities that provide wastewater services. They are going to enlighten us on water management, innovative processes, and technologies that they are utilizing in the management of wastewater, how they prioritize projects, and they are going to share some of their highest priority needs and concerns. First up, I'd like to welcome Alicia Keeter, General Manager of the South Walton Utility Company, and we will have time for a couple questions after her presentation. Ms. Keeter, you are recognized. Thank you for being here bright and early this morning. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson, Vice Chair, and Representative Hart. As said, good morning. My name is Alicia Keeter. I am the General Manager at South Walton Utility Company. Our system is located in the Western Panhandle of Florida, considered the Northwest District in Miramar Beach, servicing the area to include what you may know as Sandestin Beach Resort. We are a unique utility in that in 1968, our founding members saw a need to prepare for the future and created South Walton Utility Company. It was created as a private, not-for-profit system with just 100 paying members that created the system. Their vision established a private, not-for-profit system with just those original people. It established a utility that would be governed by a volunteer-driven board of directors, ensuring that membership would play a key role in making certain that their system was reliable and prepared for the future. Our board members are made up of our dedicated citizens of all trades and all types. This offers an environment for them to understand and appreciate our most valuable and precious resource that we have. They want to make sure that it is taken care of for years to come. In perspective to other systems, we are considered a medium-sized utility by our current number of metered connections of just 10,880. While we provide water and wastewater to a permanent population, don't let that small number fool you in our size. Our service area sees a tremendous burst in visitors during our peak operating time, and we more than double in demand with production of water and treatment of wastewater. We operate at 53 million gallons a month in January, and then we climb to a $153 million operation in the month of July. We coin ourselves the high rent district from March to October, as this creates new opportunities for us to be innovative in our approach and how we operate and maintain a system in these diverse conditions. As you can see in the slide ahead, this is our service area located in the Panhandle. We are bordered and constrained by the Choctahatchee Bay to the north and the Gulf of Mexico to the south. We are located in portions of Walton County and Okaloosa County. We basically live on an island, and this opened the doors for unique methods of operation for us. Land is extremely valuable in our area, and it is very limited. So creative planning is essential for our future expansion and growth, because, as you all know, if you build it, they will come. Our primary areas of expertise are water supply treatment, advanced wastewater treatment, and reuse disposal. We have 7 coastal water wells, and we have 6 inland remote well field locations that bring water supply to our area. Our system has 1 of 3 advanced wastewater treatment facilities located in the Panhandle. This advanced treatment adds the extra nitrogen and phosphorus removal in our system. Because of our limited land mass, this advanced treatment plant design was chosen to allow us to utilize our local wetlands as an option for discharge of our reuse water during extreme weather events. We are also able to discharge our effluent water into a local DOT drainage ditch in extreme situations. We were one of the first utilities in the Northwest District to utilize the wetlands as a disposal method as a result of our reduced nutrient loading in our area, in our water. Because of the forethought to reduce our nutrient loading back in 2006, this placed us ahead of the game for these future regulations that we're faced with today. As a system that is landlocked by the world's most beautiful beaches, from Choctahatchee Bay to the Gulf of Mexico, we had to think outside the box to handle our effluent discharge. How can we properly dispose of the reuse and still maintain the natural state of our beautiful community? Because at the end of the day, we live and we play here too. While we would wish to remain cutting edge with all of our processes, it is our membership that has to pay for all of our expenditures to stay innovative in our thinking. And with a $6 million yearly capital expenditure budget and a $9 million operating budget, it's important that we utilize whatever funding available to help us in our operations and planning to keep our membership rates as low as possible and still provide safe, reliable services to our consumers. We rely on funding from the Department of Environmental Protection, the Northwest Florida Water Management District. They open the doors for us to utilize low interest rate loans, but that does not come without an added cost. As a private, not-for-profit system, we are limited in our ways to receive funding to continue to operate as this top-notch facility. We are not in the same bucket as our other municipalities providing the same services to their customer base. Because of the one-size-fits-all language in the Clean Drinking Water Act, our utility is not afforded the opportunity to apply directly for these SRF funds out there. We must seek a sponsor to apply for the monies on our behalf, and this in turn adds more financial burden to acquire this needed funding to handle our business at hand. What we could use for our system now is allocated elsewhere to pay for fees and overhead costs. So to cut the corners where necessary and not jeopardize the finished product, we brainstorm to find new ways to operate and still maintain a high level of service to the public. One of our solutions that we face is to engage our employees in our operations and actually give them skin in the game for keeping it in check. In an effort to meet some of the requirements with regulatory compliance, we offer incentives to each department to focus on each quarter to achieve these goals. From fire hydrant maintenance, backflow compliance, sanitary sewer overflow prevention, valve system exercising, our employees are asked to go the extra mile to ensure the utility remains on top of the new rules enforced upon our system. However, there's always one of those. With the added challenges of recently passed legislation, our utility is now faced with more operational requirements that will lead us to increase our sewer and water rates to our members, our stakeholders. With an increase in rates, a decrease in available workforce, and more stringent regulations, the opportunity for us to remain a leading utility in our industry is in jeopardy. What we do internally as a medium-sized utility, what we do as a medium-sized utility allows us to keep our overhead costs down, and we remain in touch intimately with our system. We pride ourselves on being a top-notch system. We have been one of the top operating utilities in the state, as we have been recognized, and we are proud to be honored as one of the best-tasting drinking waters in our system. We have been recognized as the Wastewater Treatment Plant of the Year multiple times, and we have also received the back-to-back honor of being the state recipient of the Water Treatment Plant of the Year. We're very proud of what we do and how we do it in our area. We were also selected this year to be featured utility in the TPO magazine, which is a nationally published magazine, treatment plant operators production. With all of this said, with these recent changes to the biosolids, as you've heard today, sanitary sewer overflow focus that's coming, and asset management legislation, our already burdened system will now be challenged to locate even more funding to meet compliance with these new rules. This comes by rate increases to handle these up-and-coming changes, something our members do not want to hear. The fact of the matter still remains. With added growth and development, more byproduct is produced. The more stringent regulations imposed on our industry begs the question, what do we do with the end product? Currently, we are forced to send it to another state, not the state of Florida. And that adds more cost to our end users. We will also be limited in our disposal methods that no system will ever be able to comply and be affordable. South Walton Utility, again, prides itself on being a good steward of the environment. We show this by our efforts to remain at the cutting edge of innovative thinking and process control in our applications at our utility. However, we are faced with an uphill climb that takes us out of the running for being this top-notch facility. I urge you today to consider the impacts to all of the systems, not just the municipalities, but to all of the systems when you're promulgating new bills. We desire to keep our area the world's most beautiful beaches because our way of life depends on it. We desire to keep our area like this, but please remember that we are not one-size-fits-all makeup. We do care about our area and what that tourism is what drives our great state. It's what pays our bills at the end of the day. We value your feedback and your oversight, and that is why I am here today to share our success stories in hopes that you remember that we are not all the same. We are faced with the same challenges and as other municipalities, and with the proper planning and mindful rulemaking, we can make things happen to remain successful. In some of my pictures here on the screen on our left, we stay ahead of this. We operate with odor control. This is some of our facilities. That's reuse that we utilize for irrigation at our system to maintain the beauty and the grounds. on the right-hand side are part of our advanced wastewater treatment facility where we did our major upgrade, and we relied on that SRF funding in order to build that facility back in 2006. $18 million worth of upgrades back in 2006 would most likely equate to about $75 million now in order for us to achieve this same operational standard that we have today. At the end of the day, I leave you with one last item to ponder for future planning. When a storm comes, remember, please remember that as uncomfortable as it may be to you to live without power, you require water to live. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present today, and I will be here for questions.
Thank you. Do we have a question or two for Representative Snyder? You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much for the presentation. Thanks for being here today, and next time you come, I would love it if you could bring some samples of that award-winning drinking water. That sounded delicious, so thanks for all your hard work.
Appreciate that very much. Absolutely will. Although I know, I think my City of Tallahassee personnel might be angry if I share in that. I have to fight with David.
I don't see any others, but I do have a question. You mentioned that you have, I mean, obviously you have a tension of you have increased costs for taking care of your biosolids. You have, and you do have some sanitary sewer overflow. And I think that's one of the things that as we try, when we focus in on one thing, mm-hmm. there are other things that contribute to water quality or water degradation. And it's one of the reasons we're trying to get more of a science-based approach for what needs to be done first in each area. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just hard. On the sanitary sewer overflow issue, can you explain, is there anything that you would do in your plant maintenance, in your pipes, or are you having trouble with your lateral lines or anything like that? Is there anything you'd like to expound on that for us?
Absolutely, Chair Stevenson. Thank you very much for that. With our sanitary sewer overflow prevention, we have our robust maintenance program that we established because of this. We saw that because our system was installed originally in the early 60s, we did have a different type of material in our system that afforded more opportunity for those overflows. So we do an inspection process every quarter with our system. We focus on the areas that have higher run times in those rain events. We focus on our manhole infrastructure. We do an inspection quarterly on these. We have so many that we set up per year so that we can be ahead of the game in inspecting those areas to prevent that. And when we find that we do have problem areas, we allocate our funds in our capital planning to meet that next area.
Thank you.
However, with the system and the tourism, we are faced with limited operating times because, as you see in the map earlier, we're limited in our space, but when they come, we're limited in how we can maintain our system. So it is definitely a challenge, and it's where I ask you on that, being mindful that we're not all the same in how we operate.
Thank you for your presentation and for taking care of your water. Next up we have David Roberts, who's the Assistant General Manager for Underground Utilities and Public Infrastructure, Water Production, and Reclamation for the City of Tallahassee. So we're all relying on you every day while we're here. So yes. Welcome, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Vice Chair Maggard and Ranking Member Hart for letting me be here today to present to you. I'd like to take a second to tell you a little bit about myself as I get into talking about the City of Tallahassee. I am the Assistant General Manager for our Water and Sewer Utility at the City. I have been in this role now for 5 years, overseeing all water production and reclamation operations for the City. I started with the City 12 years ago, and prior to that, I spent 18 years in the private sector doing consulting engineering, helping small utilities, private utilities, municipal utilities, and county utilities solve complex problems to their wastewater systems. So I'm familiar with this from both the public side and the private side, which is I don't think is unique, but it certainly has some add some perspective. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about the city of Tallahassee, how we manage our wastewater infrastructure, how we incorporate technology and innovation into that infrastructure, how we prioritize our projects and investments, and some of the challenges that we face as a wastewater utility. The city of Tallahassee is we are an electric, natural gas, water, and sewer service utility. From our water and wastewater perspective, we serve 79,000 residential customers or service points and about 9,000 commercial service points with drinking water. Similarly, we service about 69,000 residential and 7,000 commercial customers with wastewater service. Our service area is predominantly the city limits of Tallahassee, but we do also serve portions of unincorporated Leon County, and we also extend into Wakulla County with our water system. Our infrastructure is vast, like most municipal utilities. We have over 900 miles of gravity sewer, which is about the distance from Tallahassee to New York City. We have 24,000 sewer manholes in our system, 143 miles of pressurized sewer pipe, and 113 pump stations that we're required to maintain. Our water infrastructure is also quite vast. We have 27 water production wells within the city of Tallahassee, 8 elevated storage tanks, about 1,200 miles of pipe, and a considerable number of hydrants and valves that we're required to maintain. Our reuse system is not quite as vast in that capacity because it's still relatively new. I would like to take just a second to acknowledge some of the achievements that we have achieved as a utility. We are ISO certified in both environmental management and health and safety. In 2015, we were recognized by the Florida Sterling Council and awarded the Governor Sterling Award for Operational Excellence. And that was reinforced again in 2018 with the sustained Sterling Award as well by the Sterling Council. So when we talk about wastewater utilities and wastewater treatment in general, I'd like to remind folks that it started as a response to a public health crisis. Today, when we think about wastewater treatment, we think about the environment predominantly, but don't forget that it started as a public health crisis and a response to that. Tallahassee's centralized sewer system first started in 1906. I was able to find some archive photos. The small picture is the installation of the sewer line on Adams Street, which is right outside the building here. And that sewer is likely the same sewer that was installed back in 1940, as it is today. And also what I have here is a photograph of one of our very first wastewater plants. This is about the complexity of what you saw back in the day. That was in 1936. Today, our wastewater facility is a state-of-the-art advanced wastewater treatment plant. We're permitted to treat about 26.5 million gallons a day of flow. We see about 17 million gallons a day on average throughout the year. When we think about innovation in wastewater management, it's important to understand some of the reasons why we innovate. We innovate to protect public health and the environment. We innovate to preserve capacity and expand our system, provide redundancy and improve efficiencies in our operations. We try to adapt to changing regulations and minimize impacts to our customers the best we can with innovation. And in general, we're trying to accomplish more with less. I can say with a little bit of pride that innovation in wastewater management started in Tallahassee, Florida. It was in 1966 when we began researching effluent reuse as spray irrigation, and we were the first to do it. This research helped shape federal and federal regulations and state policy on reuse systems. By 1984, the city of Tallahassee had achieved 100% reuse of its effluent, and we had eliminated all surface water discharges. The investments in our wastewater treatment plant and the innovation to go to AWT was done to help minimize impacts to the environment. You can see here in the graphic that we over the period of investment into the wastewater plant in that conversion, we saw significant reductions in our nutrient and specifically nitrogen loading in our effluent. The red line is the permitted values. The green and purple are actual recorded values of our effluent at that time. We were able to produce an effluent that was suitable for public access reuse. And yes, we do produce a class 2A biosolid. We did this at a cost of about $230 million to our ratepayers. We also innovate in our wastewater collection system operating maintenance. We utilize technology such as CCTV, sewer inspections, cleaning and repair technologies that don't require excavation for repairs. We do advanced data collection and analysis for our pump station operations. And we also have facility inspection programs that help us control things like grease discharges from restaurants locally, small commercial and industrial facilities to protect our infrastructure. Since 2008, which is when our advanced wastewater treatment system started, you can see the reduction in sanitary sewer overflows that we have observed in Tallahassee. To prioritize or to identify and prioritize future upgrades for treatment and disposal capacity, reliability, and performance, we utilize a master planning process. We have two master plans for our wastewater management. We have a master plan for our treatment system, and we have a master plan for our collection system. Our treatment system master plan over 5 years was done recently and has identified 39 projects totaling $78 million, and that was in 2022, dollars, and those dollars are changing quickly. Projects were done primarily for capacity and for expansion and performance. Beyond 5 years, we're looking at another $73 million in investments in our wastewater treatment plant for a total of about $151 million over a 20-year period. Again, that master plan treatment, most of those projects are geared towards replacement and rehabilitation in future years. However, we do have a few green initiatives in there as well. One of those green initiatives is a gravity thickener upgrade, and that is going to help us reduce our dependency and costs on chemical use for treatment. Another one is our conversion of our biogas. This is a natural byproduct of the wastewater treatment process, converting that to a natural gas renewable energy source. When we talk about our wastewater collection system master plan, over the last 5 years, the city has invested more than $48 million in our collection system for improvements and upgrades. And over the next 5 years, we're looking at approximately another $76 million for various projects, including pump station rehabilitations, sewer rehab, and operational and capacity improvements. The challenges we see as a wastewater utility right now, some of the most significant challenges are the unprecedented supply chain and inflationary pricing and impacts on utilities. What we have seen since the start of COVID is like nothing we've ever seen in my career, and as I talk to folks that have been in this business longer than me, have admitted the same. It has impacts on supply of chemicals, vendor contracting, where we may have been able to have a 3-year or 5-year contract with certain vendors, we're no longer able to do that. They want a 1-year contract and they want escape clauses. And it creates a significant challenge for us to ensure that we're going to have a supply of chlorine for disinfection, methanol for wastewater treatment, or polymers for different phases of our treatment process. We also see changing regulations and compliance as a challenge for our utilities. Workforce attraction and retention is another big challenge for us. And one of the most significant issues that we're seeing in recent years are the impacts private citizens are actually having on our public sewers. These are impacts that are contributing directly to sanitary sewer overflows, such as the use of flushing wipes and things that shouldn't be put down a toilet that are going down a toilet and causing problems. We also have residents of the public dumping trash, pulling manhole lids and dumping trash into the sewers. Things that, when they do it, for them it's a convenience. For us, it becomes an operational and maintenance nightmare and an environmental hazard. So with that, I'd just like to say thank you for your time. I'd be here on behalf of the City of Tallahassee, the Florida Section American Water Works Association, Water Utility Council, and the Florida Water Environment Association Utility Council. I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions representatives may have.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Of course.
I'm fascinated. Is there any questions? Do we have any questions? I look forward to talking to you a little bit about some of the dumping issues you're having. I'm very interested in that.
Be happy to do so. Thank you.
If I see no questions, I'm going to go ahead and go to our next speaker. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you kindly.
Next up, we have Renetta Marshall, the Chief Operating Officer for Jacksonville Electric Authority, or JEA. I would like to welcome you. We will have time for questions after the presentation. And so we tried to get different size entities with different kinds of challenges. And so we're really glad that you came all the way over to be with us this morning. You are recognized to present. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning. Good morning, Chair Stevenson, Ranking Member Hart, and Honorable Committee members. I am Renetta Marshall, Chief Operating Officer for JEA, and I'm delighted to be here today to talk a little bit about JEA and how we're serving Northeast Florida's water needs. But first, on behalf of our CEO, Jay Stowe, and over 2,000 dedicated employees, I'd like to take a moment to thank Speaker Renner, Representative Payne, and this committee for making it a priority to protect our precious water resources. So the agenda, so I'm going to just spend a few moments talking about JEA, talk about how we are addressing Senate Bill 64, which includes water purification criteria and how we plan projects, our capital improvement projects, and then touch on some current challenges. So JEA is Florida's largest not-for-profit community-owned water and electric utility. So we are multi-services. We provide these services to more than 1 million people in Northeast Florida while being a good steward of our natural resources and the environment. We have a 7-member volunteer board, and our board is appointed 3 by the mayor and 4 by the city council. And they consist of some of the most respected and successful members of our community. They include business owners, CEOs, and also a retired Army general. And they serve our community by providing a robust governance structure. So our service territory is vast. It covers over 900 square miles, includes 4 counties. And on the water side of the business, when you look at our infrastructure, we have 38 water treatment plants, 11 water reclamation facilities, over 130 Florida and aquifer wells, and we own, maintain, and repair 9,000 linear miles of pipe. So we're not going to go to New York and back. We're going to go to the North Pole and back, and that's how many we have. But without question, the most valuable asset that we have are our dedicated employees, over 2,000 of them that work around the clock 7 days a week to continue to provide safe, reliable, and affordable services. So this is a graphical depiction of our service territory. On the left there, that's our water service area, and on the right is our reclaimed service area in Northeast Florida. The environment is important to us, and while on the electric side, you know, we also work on environmental issues. We have reduced our carbon emissions significantly through higher efficiency generating units, nuclear power, and increasing our solar. Our water side of the business has been, and keeps doing its part. Our nitrogen discharges to the river have seen a 60% reduction over the last 20 years, even during a time that we've seen rapid population growth. We have achieved this through advanced treatment processes, replacing older technology, and expanding our reclaimed water system. But we continue to do more. So Senate Bill 64 requires the elimination of non-beneficial surface water discharges by 2032. We all know that Florida's aquifer cannot continue to support the rapid growth as is. So why water purification? So through conservation efforts, JEA has seen a 25% reduction in residential potable water use in the last 13 years. Those efforts equate to a savings of just over 9 billion gallons per year. So we're proud of these efforts. Conservation and reclaimed water alone, however, are not going to be enough. Rapid growth of the region requires sustainability in water supply, and it also requires a diverse portfolio that's going to help us protect the aquifer, and that includes purified water. Purification is cost competitive, and it also allows us to meet future demands. We began this journey back in 2015, researching the best purified water practices available, and we landed with a membrane-based process. So in 2021, we began designing and permitting a 1 million gallon per day demonstration facility that will be used to train new water plant operators and also is going to house a visitor education center around this new technology. We expect construction to be completed in 2025. So we utilize these five lenses when we evaluate capital improvement projects: water supply certainty, cost effectiveness, environmental stewardship, community acceptance, and of course, operational flexibility. So each one of these has its champions for various reasons, but the reality is that they're all important. So the type of capital projects that we have, and we have a very robust CIP or capital improvement program. It includes projects that address system capacity that's going to support new growth, address resiliency and environmental stewardship, regulatory compliance projects, and replacing and restoring our existing infrastructure. And that infrastructure keeps everything going. So for this fiscal year, we are projecting to spend $400 million, and that's just on the water side of our business, and $3.5 billion over the next 5 years. This is an example of one of our projects. This is one of three new water treatment plants that's currently under construction. This is one in North St. Johns County, and this plant is going to support future growth, provide better system pressure and reliability. We talked about septic tank phase-outs. So an example of our environmental stewardship is the septic tank phase-out program. And we are proud to partner with the City of Jacksonville on this program. It's jointly funded by JEA and the City of Jacksonville, and it's managed by JEA. And we are in the process of constructing and have constructed over 1,600 homes have been or will be connected to sewer. And also while we're in there, we find that in some of these areas, there's not water mains. So we're taking the opportunity as well to construct water mains and provide those connections. All of these neighborhoods are in areas that have been identified as point source contributors of nutrients or failing septic tank areas to the St. Johns River. So you've heard about these current challenges, and we're all seeing the same thing. JEA is not immune to these challenges. Shortages in skill and craft trades, they contribute to industry-wide shortfall. To help offset this, we are partnering with local high school, college, vocational schools to offer pathways and training for those students looking to enter into this wonderful field. Other supply changes are all facets of our business on both the electric side as well as the water. Electric is transformers, wires, cables. On the water side, it's pumps, control panels, switch gear, and everything in between. So this material lead times went from days and weeks to months and years. You've heard the saying, necessity is the mother of invention, and we have had to be very creative to address these recent challenges. You know, it includes forecasting our needs, diversifying our vendors, our manufacturers, and coming up with other ways, creative ways, to refurbish older parts. But here at JEA, we're doing our part to help solve the problems. And with that, I'm going to conclude this presentation. So thank you so much, and open up to any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Marshall? I don't see any. I will just comment that we have had presentations and discussions about the water supply being affected by the use in Georgia. So your focus on water supply and conservation is well noted. You've provided the water for my family for most of, if not all, my adult life. And you supply my district. So I appreciate your good work. You've always been responsive and as we work through issues. I wanted just to ask you kind of the question that I have asked other people. Do you have problems with, I&I infiltration? I'm sure you have a robust pipelining with the 9,000 miles of pipe, is that what you said? Where you're maintaining your pipe aggressively, are you having any difficulties or challenges in that area to preserve your capacity?
Thank you for the question. As Mr. Roberts said, similar in Tallahassee as in at JEA, we have a preventative maintenance program. The older parts of the city are typically going to see greater I&I inflow and infiltration. So those parts. We study and we address that with the preventative maintenance, the R&R programs, or rehab and rehabilitation that I was talking about, mm-hmm. as far as replacing those older sections. So a combination of our capital improvement to replace pipes as well as preventative maintenance helps with that.
Well, thank you, and we really appreciate you being here with us today to kind of help bring together. I'm sure if we had 10 more utilities, we'd hear even other things and innovations as you work to meet the needs of your community and the unique challenges you have by the age of your facilities and your topography and your water supply. So thank you so much for your service, and thanks to all the people who came and spent some of their time. Very important to the, I think they say the number one thing that has extended life in the settled world is clean water, and thank you for your work in that regard. Thank you. This concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business, Representative Maggard moves we rise. And with that, we're adjourned.